What is it that most haunts you?
I think the nightmare of reliving the moment when I was taken inside the interrogation room at the police precinct, and I was left with a detective who had not slept in over 24 hours, and he was just smoking away packs of cigarettes, and you could tell he was very stressed out. And, you know, what went on afterwards with me and that detective, no matter how much I tried to forget it, it's just certain things in life you're never going to forget. But I realized, you know, through sharing my story that it has a lot of value of educating other people and empowering other people with my story to make sure that some sort of a difference comes out of this.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is False Confessions,
a Labyrinths miniseries.
That was Johnny Hincapier, who you'll recall from episode one. Johnny was physically beaten, then coerced into memorizing and regurgitating a false confession on video in front of an assistant district attorney. That false confession sent him to prison for 25 years. But it's curious that the moment that most haunts him is seeing that detective chain-smoking in the interrogation room before the physical and mental assault began.
Trauma can do funny things to the brain, to memory. The image that haunts me most from my interrogation is seeing my phone on the table between me and the detectives, hearing it ring as my mom's name popped up on the caller ID, and they wouldn't let me answer it.
The scars left by a coercive interrogation can last a lifetime. The shock, the fear, the guilt and shame, the PTSD and lack of trust, the haunting question, what if?
I guess in my mind, I've replayed this whole entire nightmare so many times. I've asked myself, could have I not gone out that night and just stayed home with my girlfriend and avoided going to prison for 25 years for something that I didn't do? Could I have been a hero if I would have seen what actually took place and come to Brian Walken's defense and get him help or try to prevent the other person from stabbing him if I knew what was taking place? But none of that happened because, again, I wasn't there. I wasn't at the scene of the crime. I was just really beating myself up in prison thinking about this, you know, just trying to see what different outcome I could have had in my life. But at the end of the day, the one real possibility that could have deterred all of this of happening with me was if there would have been one real honest detective in the police precinct that knew what was happening to me when the detective was beating me up and would have came in and told the detective, hey, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be doing this. You're not supposed to be beating him up. You know, why are you trying to force him to give a false confession? Like, but that never took place. There was not one real honest detective that wanted to help me out.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you talk about, like, replaying in your mind alternate realities where something different happened. I've had thoughts like that, too. I just happened to meet this really sweet guy 5 days earlier and was hanging out at his house the night the crime happened. If I hadn't met Raffaele, I would have been home. And if I had been home, would me and Meredith have been able to fight off the guy who murdered her, or would we both be dead? And then, of course, I've had thoughts about, like, if only I had spoken the language better, maybe I would have been able to, you know, stand up for myself in the interrogation, or maybe I would have understood better what was happening. But, like, I remember when they slapped me the first time, and I had never been slapped in my life. Like, my mom never spanked me, like, no one. I had never been in any, like, physical fights. So, like, being slapped was a big deal for me. And I remember being just utterly shocked and really scared all of a sudden and not understanding what was happening. And that just really psychologically rattled me, and I felt really unstable. And I just spent several days, like, attempting to help them. And then they were so angry at me and I didn't understand why. And it felt like it was my fault, even though it wasn't, you know? And I also felt guilty for years afterwards, blaming myself for what happened, thinking that I was a coward and that's why I had falsely confessed, and also feeling like I was like alone in the world, not knowing that these things happen to other people. And I'm wondering, did you know from the beginning that what happened to you was not normal, or were you aware that like this could have happened to someone else? Did it feel like you were alone?
Let me just say this. Listening to what you just said, I became a little empathetic, Amanda, because, you know, every time I speak to any brother or sister of mine, exoneree, that went through something similar that I went through. And to be honest with you, the only two other people that I know that I've encountered or spoken to that were physically beaten up at an interrogation room has been you and Corey Wise from the Central Park case. Anybody else with a false confession, it was more a psychological type of coercion that took place. But everybody has endured or have been affected with some type of emotional pain or psychological pain. You know, just hearing what you just said to me, it was so poignant. You know, I was tearing up because I'm saying to myself, you know, how can you go through this? And you're not even in the United States. You're far away in another country, but yet alone at the same time. It doesn't make a difference if you're in Europe or you're here in the United States. No one should go through this.
That sense of shame and guilt for a false confession is common, even in those who didn't internalize the narratives fed to them by investigators.
When I was released, there was a press conference that we held. I felt like a coward. I felt like a coward. And I guess I still do, because I could have stood up to the cops. And maybe me and Richard don't go to prison.
Christopher Ochoa, whose false confession to rape and murder sent him to prison for 13 years before he was exonerated.
And I felt like that, but then I had one of my post-conviction attorneys, and I told him, I feel like a coward, I don't. And he said, you know what, a lot of people are not going to understand. But you were 20 years old, 22, your life was on the, and in Texas, it's a very real, it's not a threat, they will execute you. So he said, you were doing what any person would do. You wanted to survive. You wanted to live. I'm trying to make up for lost time. I guess the effects of it was I hadn't been able to, relationships, I destroyed them. I destroyed everything because I'm always scared that they're going to take it from me.
For Eddie Lowry, who confessed to a rape he didn't commit while serving as a soldier at Fort Riley, Kansas, the shame of confessing was multiplied by the parole board.
First of all, surviving in prison and being a sex offender is not fun. Every day you wake up, you wonder, is that the day you're going to die? Because sex offenders, child molesters, they're the low ones in the prison. And they're the ones that always get stabbed, beat up. If an inmate's having a bad day, that's who they look for. So I go in there and I tell them that I robbed a 7-Eleven. And I hid, and it was only by God's grace, man, I swear, man, that I made it through that whole time in prison without someone finding out that I was in there for a sex offense. You're supposed to see a parole board, and they asked me why I didn't make parole. And I said, I don't know, man. They didn't like me or something. I guess I said the wrong thing, you know. And while I'm in prison, you know, I did have to go through programs. I had to take a mental health program that I passed, you know, I completed. I had to take AA that I completed. And the big one was I had to take a sex offender course for a year. I had to go in there and admit that I raped this woman and complete this program in order to get the certificate to take to the parole board to show them that I completed this program. Because I'd been to the parole board two other times before this and told the parole board that I'm innocent and I didn't commit this crime, and they passed me for not accepting responsibility for this crime. I had a three-year-old daughter at the time, and the bad situation about that was that I guess my ex-wife at the time, who was my wife, divorced me while I was in prison, sent me a picture of my daughter when she was in kindergarten and told me, this is the last picture you're ever going to receive. And this is the last time you're going to hear from us. That's when I really started seriously thinking about completing these programs. So that's what I did. I went in and sat in a circle of sex offenders, and everybody in there was kind of quiet and not really opening up. I didn't care. I wanted to get through this program and get out of here. And so I was the first one to open up in that program and kind of explain to this group, you know, how this woman got raped. Yeah, you know, I'm sorry I did it. I don't know what I was thinking. I was drinking at the time, you know, and all this other stuff. And I just played, I basically played their game.
You did the exact same thing that you did in the interrogation room. You told them what they wanted to hear.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I look at it like, you know, I lied to go to prison because I kept telling them I didn't do this and everything. And then finally, I just made up a confession or whatever. And then I had to lie again to get out.
As for Eddie's daughter?
Yeah, I never heard from him again until after I got out. By then, she's like 14 years old, you know. And so that was really hard. You lose touch with family members, friends. You're cut off from society.
And I can say from experience, being cut off from society also changes you, especially if the thing that put you there was gaslighting by authority figures. For years, I found it hard to trust people. Jason Strong, whose false confession sent him to prison for 15 years, felt the same.
Since I've been out, it's been very, very hard to readjust to society. I find myself having a hard time trusting people because I was betrayed by so many people that I thought I knew. I say the hardest thing was when I first ever got pulled over after I got out.
Yeah.
It scared the living shit out
of
me.
I bet.
Because of everything I've gone through, I also learned how to be a bit more stoic. And so I've learned to force myself to try to do certain things. So since I've been out, one of the things I do on a regular basis is when I see police officers, I go up and talk to them. And if I get the chance, I'll tell them my story. Because I want to not only tell myself that not all cops are bad, and, you know, maybe if they hear my story, that will impact them. But two, it's kind of therapeutic. You know, it shows me that I don't have to be afraid of those guys. You know, and I know my rights. I know the law now. So if I was ever harassed, I could be like, look, I got a lawyer now. You know, this isn't going to happen again. But I say the hardest thing is just learning to readjust after living in an abysmal place. You know, prison is a weird place, as you know. There's a certain degree of honor and respect, which a lot of people don't understand because it's a lot of criminals, but there really is that thing. And so when you're out in the world, you have to learn to readjust to life where people don't often practice honor and respect. And that was a very hard thing for me to navigate. Sleeping, I have not slept good since 1999. Still to this day, I don't sleep very well. I toss and turn a lot. So there's things like that that just hang on. But the biggest is probably trust.
I beat myself up ever since it happened about why I did this. I always thought I was probably the only person in the world that ever confessed to something they didn't do. And it wasn't until I got hooked up and went to a conference with the Innocence Project that I met other exonerees who had false confessions. I was still in that fragile state of the whole confession thing because I didn't really understand it. So I was always embarrassed about that. And so I always sat at the back of the room, kind of watched everybody on our side of the room. And when I first talked to the first guy that opened up in our session and told me that he gave a false confession, I was like intrigued. I was like, wow, that sounds like my story. I went through that same thing, you know? You're not the only one that gave a false confession. It's like a club.
Yeah. What I have found is that typically there are two kinds of exonerees who have a really difficult time psychologically and emotionally even after they're released. And those two types of exonerees are people who have falsely confessed and women who are accused of murdering their children. And I think the main reason why is that if you're a woman who is accused of killing your child, whether you're innocent or not doesn't change the fact that you feel so guilty over the fact that your kid died. Because just like fundamentally on a like instinctual level, women feel responsible for their children, no matter what happens to them. Similarly, I think that people who have falsely confessed, especially before they understand that it's like a systematic process of breaking down the will of an innocent person, before you know that, you feel guilty and you feel like your own wrongful conviction is your own fault. Does that square with your experience?
Yes. I beat myself up all the time about why I confessed something I didn't do and why I chose that avenue to get out of that interrogation room. But to go a little deeper into that, it goes back to when I was a child. You know, I didn't grow up in a happy-go-lucky family. I was kidnapped from my real mom when I was 3 years old. I never saw her again. And I was raised by one of her ex-husbands who stole me from her to be mean to her. And he raised me with four brothers and his wife. There was eight of us at one time. My stepdad, who I call my dad because he's the only one I ever knew, because I didn't learn about this whole kidnapping thing until I was like in seventh or eighth grade. My sister was still telling me about it. My dad was an alcoholic and he would beat up my brother, Bo. Today he would be arrested for child abuse. He was from the country and stuff. So he'd go out and get a switch and use the switch on him, man. And you can hear Bo yelling in the bedroom. And I just wanted to get away from that kind of stuff, you know? I would always run out back, I'd leave. I just didn't want to be in around that situation where I heard him screaming. And then Earl, who was my dad, and Louise, who was my mom, they were both drinking and they both get in these very violent fights. Again, you know, I just want out of that situation. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be around this. And so when it comes down to this confession, that's the pressure I was feeling. I was just wanting out of that room so much that I was going to tell them anything I needed to tell them and clear my name later. All I wanted was out of that situation because I was devastated. I was crying. I was just emotionally drained. And I found all this out when I went to therapy. You know, I had one session in my therapy that really opened up and it helped me to internalize this whole thing better. I felt better about my whole situation, you know. I accepted the whole thing better because I had no idea why I confessed, why it went that way. But through this one therapy session, I was able to understand from my childhood how this led up to this and why I used that confession as an escape hatch.
If the phenomenon of false confessions is complex and difficult to understand, the solutions to preventing it from happening are actually quite simple. And first among them is the mandatory recording of interviews and interrogations.
When it comes to false confessions, the policy reform that had been promoted at the beginning of the movement, sort of like at the end of the 90s and early 2000s, was we need to record interrogations. We need to know what's happening in the interrogation room. And absolutely, that is essential.
Lara Zarovsky, the executive and policy director for the Washington Innocence Project.
There's no possible way to know how to fix what's happening in the interrogation room if you don't know what's happening in the interrogation room, because it's just going to be a he said, he said, she said, she said in a courtroom. If you have a recording, you can see it's the best evidence. It's not perfect because, you know, camera angles may impact it, whatever.
When they decide to turn the recording on.
When they decided, excellent. Yeah, right. Like technology is only as good as it being turned on, right? So that actually was the first effort that we went through in line with many states in the U.S. We were one of the few states that did not have recording interrogations up until 2021. And so our effort was to make sure that recording happened just so that we could preserve the best evidence. And boy, did law enforcement fight this. In fact, our founder, Jackie McMurtry, who was our founded what was then called Innocence Project Northwest in 1997, this had always been her baby. Mine was evidence preservation. I wanted DNA evidence to be preserved. Hers was recording interrogations, both legitimate, both issues that we eventually started working on. But I can't begin to express how quickly law enforcement shut down any bill effort around recording interrogations. And their argument was that people will no longer talk if they know they're being recorded. it's going to have an impact. It's going to have a chilling effect on, you know, witnesses or victims or people who have been traumatized. They don't want to know that they're being recorded.
Listen to Detective McCready, who bullied a false confession out of 17-year-old Marty Tankliff.
Why didn't you tape this confession?
We don't tape confessions. Like, we didn't then, anyway. It puts people on the gun, makes them a little more nervous than they normally would be. When they know that every single word is being recorded, and then sometimes it inhibits me as an investigator too, because I have to be very extremely cautious of the words I use and say.
Let's set aside from that argument the fact that all these other states have recorded interrogations, and that hasn't stopped prosecutions from going forward, hasn't even stopped people from confessing. And yet, it was so compelling, that voice was so compelling, you're going to stop us from being able to do our job. This is like sort of the line from law enforcement. Anytime they want to stop this, you're trying to tie our hands. You're taking tools away. Why are you trying to make our job harder?
This attitude towards recording interrogations is deep-seated and widespread, from local sheriffs to the FBI. Here's former Special Agent Steve Moore.
When I came into the FBI, until the time I was almost out of the FBI, recording interrogations was not allowed. At first it wasn't allowed, then it wasn't recommended, it was strongly discouraged, and towards the end they were allowing it. The thought there was, it's the FBI. We're not going to lie about this. We're going to tell you what happened. Honestly, Amanda, I'm not sure I ever recorded an interview, but I did my best to take contemporaneous notes. If you don't have contemporaneous notes in a federal confession case, then forget it. You're going to lose it all. You build your written record of that interrogation or interview from those notes. Those are called FD-302s, and you'll hear the term 302s. That is a recording of an interview, and I've had them from one paragraph to 13 to 14 pages. Also, when there is a confession involved with an FD-302, we have the person write out their statement so that they can write it out the way they want, or we'll write it and have them sign it. But that is only in the case of a confession.
But even Steve Moore understands how much is lost when your only record of an interrogation is textual.
But in doing that, you know, it's kind of like sending an email. You don't see the person's face. You don't see their demeanor. You don't hear the intonation of their voice or their expression.
I've often thought that I might never have been convicted if only the jury had been able to see the intensity of my interrogation, the abuse, the yelling, the slapping, and how terrified I was. But conveniently, though my phone was tapped and every other interaction I had with police in those days was recorded, the long and final interrogation into the night was conspicuously not recorded. The irony here is that Italy was actually more progressive on this issue than the U.S. It was already mandatory to record interrogations back in 2007. That's why the police and prosecution claimed my interrogation was merely an interview and that I was not a suspect, but merely a witness. And thus, I was not entitled to a lawyer, translator, or that my questioning be recorded. Italy's own courts scoffed at that argument and threw out the statements I signed as evidence for the charge of murder. Much later in 2019, the European Court of Human Rights sanctioned Italy for those same reasons. And yet, here in the U.S., this battle to record interrogations is only just now achieving real success.
In a world where we go through this pendulum of soft on crime, tough on crime, right? We can do it. No, we can't do it. And then George Floyd was murdered. That was the experience that the very next year allowed that legislation to sail through without question and only one amendment that actually made it stronger. And so we actually have one of the strongest recording laws in the country now. And part of the reason for that is that we designated law enforcement vehicles and schools as places of interrogation where juvenile interrogations have to be recorded. Otherwise, they're just like, well, we're not in an interrogation room, didn't have the equipment, couldn't do it. But now since everybody has, you know, a smartphone that has a camera and those are all issued, we wanted to really break down that argument.
But still to this day, there are something like a dozen states that don't yet require any form of electronic recording of confessions.
False confessions expert Laura Nyreiter.
You know, if you're in one of those states, you won't get the benefit of the interrogation video that we had for Brendan. And by the way, can you imagine if Brendan's interrogation hadn't been recorded? I mean, how we would never know any of what happened to him, right? You'd have, what, his word? This poor kid's word against these experienced officers' word. That's what we'd be going off, right?
Right, and he also has difficulty communicating anyway, so could he even accurately describe everything that was happening?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. No, I mean, he's got zero chance, right? He's got zero chance. So recording one of the most important reforms, there's still some states yet to adopt it. So that is really, really sort of foundational. Once we then had states that were recording interrogations and we could look at these videotapes and say like, okay, what's going on in this interrogation room? That was the first glimpse we had into this cloaked in secrecy world of the interrogation room were these early tapes. And once we started watching those tapes, you know, it's like, oh, now we're learning about these techniques. Oh, now we're seeing all this trickery. And so the next wave of reforms focused on those techniques, right? How can we eliminate the interrogation techniques that are associated with the risk of false confession while still enabling police to do their job, just do it better?
And foremost among those techniques is the use of deception during interrogations.
So these kinds of lies are probably the cudgel that brings suspects down to a place of hopelessness very, very quickly during the course of the interrogation. They're an extremely powerful tactic in interrogations, and they're not necessary.
Steve Drizin.
We here in Illinois were the first state to enact legislation that didn't actually ban the use of lying, but it made it so that when police officers did it, it became harder for the prosecution to use confessions that were the result of deception. We focused only on young people because we thought victories with young people would open the door for later victories with all suspects. And we were successful, and we were successful in Oregon as well. And it's been, I think, up to 8 states which now have banned deception, or at least, as you say, disincentivized it. So I think this is a wave that is coming. It'll probably take years. Because police officers in the United States value lying. They see lying as something that is necessary for them to get down on the same low-level moral plane as suspects. And if suspects are going to lie to them, they feel that they have free range to lie to suspects. What they don't realize is that when you lie to suspects, when you deceive suspects, you end up breaking the fabric between police officers and the communities that they serve in such a way that the esteem of law enforcement falls, and it makes it harder to solve cases.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking, like, as long as nobody knows they're lying, it's fine.
Exactly.
But then as soon as the cat's out of the bag, then everyone's like, so you motherfuckers, you're just fucking with all it. Like, I can't talk to you.
Exactly. You know, unfortunately, because there's been, you know, 50 years almost of case law that have blessed police officers' use of deception, they haven't paid a price for lying. It's just one factor in the totality of the circumstance in determining whether or not a confession is involuntary. And it's not a very important factor. Courts say they're allowed to lie. So we're trying to change that.
That was the logic behind House Bill 1062 that we've been working on for the past 2 years that you testified on behalf of.
Laura Zarovsky of the Washington Innocence Project. Amanda testified alongside her and exoneree Ted Bradford in support of this bill during the 2024 legislative session.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amanda Knox, and I am here in support of this bill. A lot of people think that the worst day of my life was very likely the day that I walked into court and I was convicted as an innocent person, and I was sentenced to 26 years in prison as a 22-year-old. But it was not. The worst day of that entire ordeal was the day that I was interrogated overnight by police officers who claimed to have evidence against me, who claimed that there were witnesses who could place me at the crime scene, that there was evidence of me in the house where my roommate was murdered. They lied to me. I did not know they could lie to me. And they presented a false reality to me that they knew exactly what happened to my roommate. They knew that I was involved, and my job was to cooperate with them. I started to doubt my very sanity. And I believe that if I had not been lied to by the police, none of this would have ever happened. I never would have been put on trial. I never would have gone to prison.
You'll recall that at that same legislative hearing, James McMahon, the policy director for the Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, also testified.
James McMahon testified that, yeah, we have to lie to people. We have to lie to people all the time. And he continued to rattle off about four or five different examples of all the ways that law enforcement lies to the public and how necessary and essential and, not optional this is. It's really the only way to do our jobs. And I think just the fact that James felt comfortable saying that and seemed to really believe it, the fact that that is where we are should be raising red flags for everyone. It is not a fact that law enforcement has to lie to people in order to do their jobs. That's not true. And in fact, because other countries don't do it, right? Other countries don't allow it. Garbage in, garbage out. If you lie to somebody, what you're going to get back is just as likely to be unreliable. And in this moment where they're supposed to be concerned about community relations and trust in law enforcement, it becomes this us or them. They're supposed to be here representing and protecting us as a community. And so if we say it's unacceptable for you to lie to people, we are also saying we accept that means that sometimes you're not going to get the confession from the guy that you think is the bad guy, even if it's an actual perpetrator. Because here's the thing, if you don't have enough evidence to prosecute that person other than their statement, maybe you shouldn't be prosecuting them, right? Like that's right. The key, that's the thing that gets lost in all of these discussions. Is that going to keep you from getting some confessions to prevent you from using deception in interrogation? Uh-huh. Sure is. It's going to stop you from getting some confessions. And that's a good thing, because while it may keep you from getting some legitimate or true confessions, it's also going to throw out the bad confessions, which is completely antithetical to everything that we are in the United States. And so, yeah, the resistance is wild. It was also unequivocal. And I will say this, I've also been impressed to learn that James attended a law enforcement training session around interrogation techniques and started to learn more about non-coercive interrogation techniques subsequent to the bill hearing in January, and has engaged at least at some level in conversation about this. And there are some methods that he seems actually open to learning more about. What I would like to see is members of actual law enforcement, not just their policy director, engaging in this conversation and actually considering alternatives, because it's just been shown over and over and over again to be more effective to have a rapport-based interrogation practice than to use coercion and lies.
Why is it that legislation that is banning deception for juveniles is passing, but legislation that is potentially going to be banning deception towards adults is not passing?
of course, these deceptive lies and all of these other forces, psychological forces in the interrogation room, of course they work on adults like kids. It is true that kids are particularly vulnerable, right? Or young people. And I would include very much, by the way, a 20-year-old in that category. But these laws that I'm talking about that are passing are 18 and under, in most cases, under 18. To start with the most vulnerable group was the politically viable thing to do. It was an answer that could begin, that could launch some real change for that group. What we're seeing is this is still working, right? You don't need to lie to get reliable statements from people. You don't need to lie in order to solve crimes. And, you know, once we sort of see that this is working, okay, it's very much my hope that we can expand this reform to include everybody, right? Because this is a problem for everybody. Kids are more likely to falsely confess. We know that from the body of evidence that's out there. But this is a reform that should, by rights, you know, cover everybody. And I very much hope it does one day.
As advocates make more progress on reforming how suspects are interrogated, there's also concern about how witnesses are interviewed.
This is, in my mind, the next frontier. Now we know that we have all these videos, right, of these interrogation techniques being used on suspects. But when you investigate a case and you go out and, you know, police don't just talk to suspects, they also talk to witnesses. And frankly, the only tool that many, many police officers are given in their training are these set of interrogation techniques. So they use them not just with suspects, but also with witnesses, right?
There has a long-standing literature that goes back further back than even the confessions literature that shows that eyewitnesses make mistakes for various reasons. A number of these cases involve witnesses who recant their testimony and said they gave it under pressure. You can imagine if an interrogation is powerful enough or deceptive enough to get you to implicate yourself, well, of course it'll get you to implicate somebody else.
The difficulty here is that a witness to an investigation doesn't have the same legal protections that the suspect, the defendant, has. So it's much harder to challenge witness statements in court, right? We all have a right against forced self-incrimination, right? Keyword self. But I don't really have a right for the police to not come over to you and start, you know, telling you better incriminate me, right? So it's much harder to attack and expose those statements in court through sort of traditional legal means. But this is absolutely happens all the time. I think we need to be recording witness statements just as much as we are recording suspect interrogations. You know, I think that would teach us a lot.
It happens all the time. You know, they get somebody who was, you know, from the same neighborhood, who may have been out on the street when the crime occurred, and they interrogate them just like they interrogate suspects. And they oftentimes will accuse the witness of being a suspect. Okay, and so they get the witness to identify the suspect as the perpetrator. Then they go through steps to make that identification seem more legitimate, right? Photo arrays, lineups, both of which can be manipulated. But even before that happens, sometimes what they do is once they lock a suspect into a story, whether it's true or false, they bring the witness to the grand jury. They get the witness under oath, and then they can hold perjury charges against them if the witness changes their story. So the truth of the matter is that when police officers really want to build a case against somebody they think is guilty, they will often engage in some of the same tactics against witnesses. And that's why we've always called for a recording of all interviews and interrogations, including witnesses, so we can see whether or not they were subjected to the same pressures.
Police are not supposed to interrogate witnesses or third parties, but I've seen many, many cases of this.
Psychology professor and false confessions expert Richard Leo.
And it would be like if there was an eyewitness examination. Eyewitnesses to crime typically will either see a lineup of six people, one would be a suspect, the other five would be fillers, or a computer-generated photograph or simulation. Imagine if the police said, look, it's number three. Tell us it's number three. And then the witness says, oh, yeah, it's number three. That's what happens when police use interrogation techniques on witnesses and pressure and persuade them to give the police what they want to hear. It's fraudulent. It's coercive. It's the exact opposite of the pursuit of the truth. And it leads to the wrongful conviction of innocent people. I believe the National Registry of Exonerations, which lists all the sources of error, causes of the wrongful convictions in their database of 3,500 cases, lists false and perjured testimony as one of the leading causes. And that's often the product of police pressure and suggestion and coercion of witnesses.
So in a perfect world in which deception is banned, interrogations are recorded, and witnesses aren't interrogated or coerced, what would police work look like?
The goal is not to stop police from doing their work. The goal is not to stop them from getting confessions. The goal is to get the confessions from the guilty, not from the innocent. And alongside the literature on what causes false confessions is now an exploded hundreds of studies on science-based methods of interrogation, although they use the word interviewing, not interrogation. Science-based methods that, like you say, you establish a rapport, you ask open-ended questions, you look for inconsistencies, and they're finding that the results they get are more diagnostic, which is to say they continue to get confessions from the guilty, but less so from the innocent. And so the goal is not to stop confession evidence. The goal is to stop false confessions. And let me just stop for a moment and make a point that always seems to get overlooked. Because this is not a law enforcement versus academics conflict. There's someone in California who's pushing for a ban on deception. I wrote an article a year ago in which I took comments from six law enforcement professionals. I mean, people who interrogated terrorists, for example, in the military. And these six had in common that they had the enlightened view that deception doesn't work. It produces false confessions. It diminishes the public trust in police.
But there are those in law enforcement who recognize this problem and are pushing for change, like DA Vern Pearson.
I'm the elected district attorney in El Dorado County. I've been a prosecutor for 32 years, prosecuted all sorts of cases. And then the last several years, I've been increasingly involved in the way that we train detectives here and within California and beyond, really nationally. Having been a prosecutor for a long time, I'm not at all what you might heard the terminology, a woke prosecutor. I'm pretty aggressive, and I prosecuted all sorts of cases including, you know, putting someone on death row for the murder of a police officer. If you talk to experienced prosecutors throughout the United States, as I have, if you ask them, what is your main complaint about most detective interviews, they will say, The detective is talking 80% of the time, the subject is talking 20% of the time, and that needs to be reversed.
This kind of perspective on how an interrogation should be conducted can be found in alternatives to the Reed method, like those developed by the high-value detainee interrogation group.
They were created in the aftermath of the enhanced interrogation program that took place in Afghanistan and Iraq. They were given a bunch of money. It was the CIA, DOD, and FBI, and basically told, go out and hire a bunch of researchers to figure out what works in interviewing. If torture works, prove torture works. If torture doesn't work, prove torture doesn't work. That was the mindset that they had. And a significant amount of research was done as a result of that. They looked at thousands of hours of actual interrogations, interviews of terrorists, of murderers, of sex offenders. And they looked at the behaviors and coded the behaviors of the interviewers, the interrogators, and said, what is the interrogator doing? And then what is the reaction from the person who's being interviewed? And can we identify behaviors on the part of the interrogator that are associated with more yield of information? In other words, if you're looking for yield, when is the person that's being interrogated revealing more fact-based information, and then comparing that to what the interrogator is doing. And what they found was that the more aggressive the interrogator was in that sense, the less yield, the less information, and that when the interviewer was perceived by the person being interrogated as being humanly warm in terms of not being their friend, not being fake, but being recognizing this is a human being I'm speaking with. And the interrogator was perceived as being competent. In other words, they're very good at their job and they're humanly warm to this person. The yield goes way up dramatically. Either one of those things taking it away and the yield goes down. Their analysis and their characterization of it is that the rapport-based approach is the by far the most effective way of getting information. We simply do not need dishonesty to get people to be truthful. The use of deception destroys rapport. And if the person confesses, then the person confesses. If the person tells you an elaborate lie and you ask more and more information about it and you say, tell me more about that, explain to me how that could be, eventually the lie unravels. And so then you can see that it's a lie. So that whole methodology is built into what the HIG does. In other words, if you're lazy, the best way to close the case and move on to the next one is a confession. However, for competent prosecutors, competent trial attorneys, we like the lie every bit as much as the confession. Mm-hmm. In fact, if a detective is very good at eliciting a very detailed lie from someone who's committed a serious crime, that just means we'll do a trial and we'll be able to portray to the jury all the lies that this person has told. And juries don't have much difficulty with that, but it requires us to work a little bit more, maybe a lot more. Over the last 4 years or so, we've been training detectives throughout California. It's become the standard in California through the California Post Peace Officer Standards and Training. And we've also been doing the training beyond outside of California, including Miami and a number of other jurisdictions are all adopting the same type of approach because it works, it's more effective, and it's also ethical.
And then here's one final point. When we sweat over false confessions, yes, it's, as your case shows perfectly, it is a horror and a tragedy to the person you've misidentified, their friends, their family, and whatnot. But there's another cost. And when I've testified at state legislatures with a proposal to ban lying about evidence, and I hear a law enforcement opposition witness get up and say, we're trying to keep the streets safe. Hang on a second. You're trying to keep the streets safe by closing a case on an innocent person? Brilliant study published a couple years ago showed that when you go back and look at the Innocence Project DNA cases, where of course everyone who's exonerated is excluded in the DNA, sometimes when that DNA is placed into the national database, it gets a hit to the actual perpetrator who escaped prosecution to begin with. Well, what these researchers did was they went back and looked at, I believe the number was 109 of cases where the DNA identified the actual culprit. And they went back and tracked what that culprit did since that point. 102 out of those 109 who escaped arrest and prosecution went on to commit additional, usually violent crimes.
Wow.
Leading them, these researchers, to extrapolate that some 40,000 crimes a year could have been prevented if an innocent person hadn't been wrongfully convicted for something else.
Ugh.
And so my point is, when you close a case on an innocent person with a false confession, the actual offender remains locked and loaded and poised and ready to reoffend. And that's not making the streets any safer for any of us.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important things we hope you take away from this series is that we are all at risk of finding ourselves in the crosshairs of a guilt-presumptive coercive interrogation, whether as a suspect or witness to a crime, or in the workplace, or at school. So, what should you do if you find yourself in the hot seat?
You should never be in a room with police for more than an hour, really.
Retired FBI Special Agent Steve Moore.
You have daughters. Have you ever talked to them about talking to law enforcement? And if you had been my dad when things were going down in those early days, what would you have been telling me?
I would have told you all the same thing. If you're in there for more than 2 hours and they are asking you questions that seem to have to do with culpability, just say, you know what? I need to go talk to my dad or my lawyer. If they ever make an accusation against you, it's over. The interview's over. Say, I'm leaving. Get a lawyer.
What if they say you don't get to talk to your dad or you don't get to leave?
Then you're not in the United States and you're screwed. You say, can I please have a pen? And you write down what they said. You're not allowed to talk to your dad. You're not allowed to see a lawyer. And write the time down and hand it to them and ask them to sign it. And if they won't sign it, fold it up and put it in your pocket. Say, at this time, I said this. Make a record of everything you do. They're taking notes. You take notes. If you're innocent, you've got nothing to lose. Don't repeat your story. When they say, tell us what happened, tell them what happened. When they say, okay, let's start over. Let's go back to that room. Okay. You say, nope, already asked and answered. Because what they're trying to do is manipulate you and confuse you. Then when your stories don't match perfectly, they can come to you and say, but Amanda, you said you went through the front door at 11 and now you're saying 10:30. You say, well, I don't know. I could have gotten that wrong. Really? What else could you have gotten wrong?
Once they read you your Miranda warnings, you are a suspect.
Steve Drizin.
They don't do that unless you're a suspect. So if they read you your Miranda warnings and they ask you to give them up, to sign them away, you say, why are you reading my Miranda warnings? Am I a suspect? And they'll probably say, no, this is just something we have to go through. You've seen it on TV 1,000 times. It's for your protection as well as ours. You say, no. You're reading me my Miranda warnings. I'm a suspect. I want an attorney. And you can't talk to me until I get an attorney. Those Miranda rights are precious. They are a constitutional right. You don't throw them away like they're a piece of garbage, no matter how much law enforcement officers try to get you to do that. So, you know, maybe... You know, I don't think they should talk to police officers at all without an attorney present. So the attorney can find out, you know, whether you're a suspect or whether you're a target or just a witness. But if you do, once they read you your Miranda warnings, you shut that process down.
Mm-hmm. What about before that, though? Because, you know, I was never read my Miranda warnings or the Italian equivalent of them. And so many witnesses are not. Like people who are just being interviewed as persons informed of the facts are still going to find themselves bullied or psychologically manipulated. What advice do you have for those who do not reach the level of their Miranda rights being read to them?
Once you tell your story, and that story is truthful, right? It's your truth. When they start to try to change your truth to fit their truth, you shut it down. Okay, they're not accepting your truth. That's it. Okay, you say no more. I'm not going to talk until I have a lawyer, because that's when they are trying to get you to make admissions or a confession, and you got to shut it down.
Okay, and what if they say, well, you know, don't you want to cooperate with us? Aren't you one of the good guys?
You say, I did cooperate with you. I told you my truth. I told you my story. I gave you the names of these people who can back it up. And you refused to accept it. So that's where we draw the line.
Can I also ask about that closed door? Because, like, one thing that my interrogators say, and they continue to say this to this day, is they say that I had the right to walk out of that room at any point. Even though the door was shut, I had the right to walk out of that room, and I just stayed there voluntarily. Can we talk about that closed door and when you think you should just stop being polite and get the fuck up and walk out the door?
I think that is asking way too much of a suspect. You've got a door that's closed. You've got two usually larger interrogators in front of you. They are closing the space between you and them. They are increasingly getting agitated. And for anybody to expect a suspect to stand up and walk out of the door under those circumstances is terribly unfair. All I can say at that point in time is the suspect needs to push back on the idea that on the tape, on the camera, can I leave? You know, I want to leave. Can I leave? Can I make a phone call? Can I, you know, can you get my parents in here? I want to speak to a lawyer. Parents, unfortunately, don't do a good job of protecting suspects, but they do provide a sense of comfort to suspects. At least there's another witness to what the police officers are doing. But the door being closed is an important part of this for interrogators because they insist that privacy is absolutely necessary to getting a suspect to talk. And they will often say to you, you know, you're free to leave at any time. They say that at the beginning of the interrogation, and then it becomes like it doesn't even exist anymore by the time they're working over a suspect. It's just another part of that script that makes it easier for a judge or a jury to find later on that this was all voluntary.
I guess it depends on the situation, right?
Richard Leo.
Were you walking your dog and then there was a car accident and somebody ran and they want to get your statement about what you saw or heard? Or is your baby in the hospital and the police now want to talk to you about your baby's injuries, which, you know, may have been metabolic or genetic, but you don't know why your baby started coughing blood or, right? So you could have a range of situations where it could be an interview or it could be an interrogation. I guess what I would say is when police say to you, I need you to come to the station, you don't have to go to the station. Don't go to the station. If you want to take my statement, I'm happy to talk to you here. I would say insist on a recording of any statement. We all have iPhones. You can press the recording button, right? You can always walk away unless they arrest you. You say, I don't want to talk to you. My tendency would be to be helpful to them if it's a witness situation. But if you are being accused of anything, whether it is subtle or whether it's explicit, I would say I would feel much more comfortable if I spoke to a lawyer first. Once you start being accused, they've made up their mind and their goal is going to be to get a confession. There's a book that I assigned to my undergraduates. It's called You Have the Right to Remain Innocent. It's a very small book. I would recommend it to everybody. The most interesting thing about the book may be the subtitle. What police officers teach their children. Police officers teach their children, you don't speak to the police. You don't let yourself be interrogated. The whole book is an illustration through scholarship, through stories written in a very plain way about how police can ensnare and entrap, and the legal system enables them to, people who are completely innocent. So in the example of a parent whose 5-month-old baby was suddenly coughing up blood and had red spots. And now they go to the emergency room. They haven't slept for 24 hours. And now the police want to come and talk to them. What that parent typically does not know is that the police are trying to get the person to admit that they did something that could have caused those injuries. And it starts out just as question and answer, rapport building, and eventually becomes accusatory. We know from the last 20, 30 years of research, shaken babies have been discredited. There's lots of causes of injuries to babies have nothing to do with parental abuse. Now, that might be an extreme example because, you know, most people's interactions with police are in automobiles, right? You get stopped by the police. We've all been stopped. The police come up to you and they say, "Do you know why I stopped you?" Now, that's a trick question. That's a question designed to get you to confess. And when the police stop you in your car, you're not free to leave. But the Supreme Court, going back to the 1980s, basically gaslighted Americans by saying that you're not in custody. Because remember, if you're in custody and police seek to elicit incriminating statements, you're entitled to Miranda warnings. They said, no. When you're stopped by cars, you're not in custody. So you're not entitled to Miranda warnings. So the police just say, "Okay, do you know why I pulled you over?" You say, "Well, maybe I was going 10 miles over the speed limit," right? And then, of course, you've just confessed. Now, you know, that's not consequential in the way that the cases we've been talking about are. But I would say just remember that if police are trying to get incriminating evidence from you and you did not commit a crime, you do not need to talk to them. And you can always say, "I would like to consult with a lawyer first." I would say be respectful. Always be respectful of police and always be declarative. Don't ask police, "Should I get a lawyer?" Because they are your adversary if they are trying to get evidence against you of a crime, and you may not even know it. So I would say be instinctively distrustful, be respectful, cooperate if it's purely a witness role. But once they start to accuse you, or you feel accused, certainly if you've been read your Miranda warnings, I don't think there's any percentage in talking to them. They are professional liars. They're very good at it. When I say they're professional liars, I don't mean that in a demeaning way. Police work is dirty. It's not fun. It's necessary. They need to use psychological techniques to get evidence. Oftentimes the evidence is accurate and it leads to the prosecution of the guilty. Too often it leads to the prosecution of the innocent. We can do better. We will do better.
And a big part of this is simply educating the public, all of us potential suspects, witnesses, and jurors, about how memory works, about how the coercive pressures of an interrogation can lead someone to falsely confess and cause a wrongful conviction, punishing the innocent and leaving the guilty free to commit more crimes.
So we hope this deep dive into false confessions has been enlightening for you and that you'll spread the word to help educate others. Please share this podcast on social media. Tell your friends. Tell a cop. Tell a prosecutor. Tell a judge.
In the meantime, get lost with us.
Find us on Blue Sky at amandanox.com.
At wisecracker.bsky.social.
On Instagram at amamanox.
At mccarbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at amandanox.com. And my partner, he's kind of a hothead. So instead of bringing him back in, how about you just leave us a 5-star review?
False Confessions, a Labyrinth miniseries, is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, along with our managing producer, Andre Sapp, and our production assistant, Charlie Darnell. Our theme music is by Josh Budo-Karp.